you, Dennis, are someone who's kind of pulling together, I would say, a network of networks of atmospheric monitoring stations around the world, which are keeping track of CO2 flux. Is that a reasonable overview?
Perfect.
People are independently operating these data collection towers, which, and maybe you should just briefly explain what the device is that does the collection.
Right. Well, let me give you a little history. Back in the late 50s, David Keeling made some of the first measurements of carbon dioxide concentration. And these started out in Mauna Loa and on that mountain in Hawaii,
yeah,
and in the Arctic and very remote areas. And they saw this increase of CO2 concentration in the wintertime. They'd see a decrease in the summertime. Increase was often due to respiration by the biosphere. The decrease was due to photosynthesis by the biosphere. And then on top of that, they saw this secular trend due to fossil fuel combustion and logging of tropical forests for the most part, essentially. And they're just concentration. Atmospheric scientists, we know that changes in concentration in the atmosphere are due to fluxes. And that's how we got involved. We, as micrometeorologists, measure actual fluxes, so moles of carbon dioxide per meter squared per second between the atmosphere and the biosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it with a combination of sensors. One is what's called a three-dimensional sonic anemometer. And this sensor measures up and down motions of the air and lateral and longitudinal motions of the air 10 times per second. So essentially we're measuring all the turbulent ups and downs of the atmosphere. And simultaneously with new sensors, we actually measure the instantaneous changes in CO2 concentration also.
So it's a combination of wind speed sensing and atmospheric gas sensing.
Absolutely. And so we measure a covariance between these two.
Okay.
And theoretically, this covariance is related to this flux density.
Okay.
And so in essence, it was a combination, to be honest with you, of microcomputers, new technology. I mean, the PCs and, you know, Microsoft operating systems, you know, really opened up the ability for us to have small computers we could take out into the field and connect to these new developments and solid-state sensors, essentially.
So the population of sensors worldwide has been growing, it sounds like, for, you know, 15 or more years.
Yeah,
right?
the earliest ones, well, my old lab in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, made some of the first open-path sensors that we were using kind of in the early 90s. And around then, this company called LIGHTCOR started building a closed-path infrared gas analyzer that could measure carbon dioxide and water vapor at about 5 to 10 times per second. And then they also developed an open-path sensor that many of us use that essentially is about 15 centimeters long, that shoots an infrared beam from a source to a detector. And so the air can blow through this sensor.
Mm-hmm.
The nice thing about this sensor is it's low power, it doesn't need pumps, so it could be deployed in the middle of nowhere, essentially. And many of us run our systems off of solar panels. So we have a PC that may pull an amp, and these sensors will pull another amp, so about 2.5 amps we can run a flux system.
Mm-hmm. So as Catherine was pointing out to me in email, there is a long tradition in some scientific disciplines of large-scale collaboration, but it's relatively new in other areas, and it sounds like this is an area where you folks are making it happen in a way that it hasn't happened before. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember I was a grad student of these early 80s, and I still remember my professor having, you know, a desk full of data, and you know, a few people would come and knock on the door and want to actually borrow the data. There's always some reluctance. It was still a single investigator culture at the time.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, I kind of give credit to our Italian colleagues. They're really gregarious, and we're good at hosting wonderful workshops that started bringing people together. And once we got to know each other, then people started working together. I think also motivation is you learn more about your own site when you can see data from other sites to learn how the systems are functioning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that kind of moved things forward. And then the funding, I think, also helped too. Obviously, if there's money for networks, people are more willing to collaborate. If anything, our concern is, will this funding keep going into the future? This is a big, big concern because we have been successful for 10 years now, and funding agencies continue to want to support these long-term efforts.
So, Catherine, how did Microsoft get involved in helping build out this scientific data server? People can see it or part of it at flexdata.org.
Well, it was one of those great serendipity sort of things that happened. We had met folks at the Berkeley Water Center through a combination of two things. First, Jim Gray being interested in e-science and database applications. And secondly, it turns out that one of the current heads of the Berkeley Water Center is an old friend of mine from grad school, Jim Hunt. And we had started talking about doing a hydrology project, and we're kind of still in the scratching our heads, what do we want to do phase, when somehow or another, my colleague at Berkeley Water Center on the computing side, Deb Agarwal, ran into Dennis. And we started talking, and Dennis fit all of the criteria for how I like to engage with scientists, in that he was desperate. He had a problem that he didn't know how to solve. And desperate's
Choking on
important
data.
because that means he was willing to talk to us
Yeah,
and
highly motivated.
teach us things. And he had enough data that it was interesting to us. It's not, petabytes, but we're talking about gigabytes of data in the sort of 100 gigabyte kind of range. And the data set was also extremely diverse. I find it fascinating from an informatics sort of point of view because it's a true scientific mashup to do the data analysis. You're taking both the FluxNet data that Dennis has just described, as well as a lot of site properties, as well as other things that come from the literature, trying to all make them come together.
Yeah, there's, as far as I can see, a few different moving parts here. So first of all, it appears that there are a couple of different collection networks that are not necessarily aligned. And then as well, there's a whole range of what I think you folks call ancillary data, which has to do with, now that we've got the atmospherics, what about the environment, right? What is the vegetation and the soil and what's going on, otherwise in the environment? So all of those things need to be kind of woven together, right?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons that I think working with environmental scientists is just so wonderful, because you really are taking data inevitably from a number of different sources and trying to bring it together.
Well, to give you an example, the meteorological data from the database point of view is kind of simple in a way. It's very regular. We have computers and data loggers that essentially give us half-hour data. So essentially, you have this nice Excel spreadsheet of rows and columns. The rows would be a timestamp for maybe every half hour, day in and day out. Each column would be temperature, flux of water, solar energy, et cetera. But then the complexity comes in of weaving this ancillary data because, for example, we need to know the population of leaves out in the field that control these fluxes. This is called leaf area index.
Yeah.
And you may just go out and measure that at five or six spots, six or seven times a year. And then you may need to understand photosynthesis of the leaves. And so you go out and measure a whole different suite of other types of measurements. And those are different heights and different species. And then you need to take some soil measurements of soil texture and soil carbon, properties of the soil in terms of how much water does it hold. And again, these are all at different depths, different times, et cetera. And that's where it really gets complicated, though.
And presumably, there are all sorts of different methodologies for combining these variables, and as you move from continent to continent and region to region, these sensors are in environments where people think differently about those issues, right?
Yeah, I guess so. You have to work with more with the ancillary data than I have. Have you come up with any new insights, Catherine, on how these data are merged together or better ways for us to report it or et
Well, I think
cetera?
we've been working with the Ameriflux Collaboration in Bev Law in Oregon to kind of come up with a new reporting protocol, a more detailed protocol. The existing FluxNet data uses the carbon reporting protocol from the Europeans. So there's a slightly different shape to the data. Basic challenge of how to weave the ancillary data, the fire data, the biological data in with the flux data, though, remains regardless. It's really interesting. Another kind of interesting aspect from us, from our side, has been doing something that I think is really fascinating, is handling time. We all think that time is pretty linear, right? I mean, the sun comes up, the sun goes down. But
according to Einstein.
Yeah, well.
Get that Lorentz function in there.
we discovered at one point the notion of par days. Since we're dealing with plant information, plants photosynthesize during the day.
Mm-hmm.
So a measure of day or night, rather than using kind of wall clock time, using the plants to tell us when day or night was, really fascinating. So effectively, we're deriving a time window based on the time series data themselves. And for informatics folks, this was just more fun than a barrel of monkeys. We've generalized the concept now. We've applied it in a couple of other disciplines. But handling time is turning out to be one of the biggest areas of learning, I think.
Well, that's actually a good point, because some of the processes we need to look at are very nonlinear with time. And if you come up with an algebraic mathematical average, you'll get the wrong number. But if you weight it by the sunlight on the day length, you'll get a more representative, better answer. So, yeah, that's a good point, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me back up and ask what I probably should have asked first off, which is what is FlexNet, actually? What does this network of sensors consist of? And how does this data get into the scientific data server that you've built, and then we can talk about what happens to it once it's there.
FlexNet started really in about the 1997. There was a call from NASA to essentially create a network of sites to help validate this satellite called EOS, which has the platform for this MODIS sensor that really is looking at Earth's observation properties. Measuring reflected sunlight at about 1 kilometer resolution in a selective wave bands to try and detect photosynthesis, leaf area index, various factors. So that was kind of the origins of it, and it all kind of started out of a workshop we held in Italy in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
From that, these regional networks started blossoming. The first one to get off the ground was the Euroflex network led by Riccardo Valentini. And then Meriflex started probably around late 97. And then with time, the Asians got a network going, the Canadians. And so we've had various funding over the years. NASA funded us through two cycles, and then money dried up as they decided to go to the moon and the Mars. And most recently, we were funded by NSF through a project called RCN, which is Research Coordinated Networks. So our National Science Foundation is funding a whole bunch of ecological networks, including some with phenology that relate to the timing of plant behavior. Another one is on carbon isotopes, and then there's our project. And at this stage, it's funding a postdoc and giving us funds to organize international workshops to bring scientists together. And on the side, there's been funding to Oak Ridge National Lab through NASA to maintain this data archive and acquisition system. And then Deb and Catherine have kind of joined in with us and helped a lot to build value-added products, really with their own support, through this fluxdata.org project. So it's kind of growing on itself. I always kind of view myself a little bit as Tom Sawyer, that we got this fence to paint, and all these people are helping us paint this fence. And
Or like a nice product in the end. Or like stone soup, right?
It
is like stone soup. From an informatics point of view, I think the way we think about it is that the data starts with tower owners, and Dennis, for example, is a tower owner as well as an overseer for the entire science.
A tower being the thing that mounts the instrumentation?
That actually holds the instrumentation.
Yeah.
So there's 467, I think it is, towers that we know about worldwide.
Oh,
that may not be the full number. And that's operated by well over 200 people. Some people own more than one.
I'm operating three sites, for example.
Yeah, and not all the sites are currently operational. Mm-hmm. So the data flows from the investigator to one of the either network repositories or, for the case of sites that don't belong to a network, directly to Oak Ridge, where the data is stored.
Okay, so the site that you pointed me to, Flex Data, is not the repository. It's an analysis thing.
Yeah. I mean, what's happening in a lot of the environmental sciences is there are DACs, data access, data archive centers, that are funded by NASA, by NSF, by DOE, primarily NASA, where you can contribute data and where data is stored. The challenge for a scientist is to get from the DAC to the science, and it's kind of that classic cable last 20 feet problem. So the data flows for Fluxnet, the data flows from the repositories, the network repositories, to the folks in Europe who are actually doing the gap filling and quality assessment, that are doing the uniform processing. It flows back from them to the DACs, so back to Oak Ridge, so that Oak Ridge has, again, the archive product, long-term storage, and it flows to us. And we then get available to the researchers who are using the data so they can download it. We also put it into the database, make the value-added summary products, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess I think of our role as closing that last 20 feet. We're not at the front end actually taking data. We're not the long-term repository, but we're closing the gap.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is putting the stuff into data cubes. And I found a statement, in it might have been written by Dennis or anyway some other folks as well. One of the reports I found on the site that says data cubes have been used for financial analysis for over 10 years, but their application to science data is new. The benefit is near instantaneous analysis of large data sets. That might surprise some people to think that way of looking at data isn't in fact common in the scientific world.
It actually isn't. OLAP databases, data cubes, have been around for that period of time. I think I first saw one back in, the early 90s. But that was really commercial data. It was about finding how to make coupons for Oreos and milk. Scientific data is actually different than commercial data in a couple of respects. First, it's much more dense. You tend not to always buy Oreos and milk together, but Dennis always reports CO2 flux, temperature, precipitation, et cetera, together.
Mm-hmm.
The other difference is that a lot of the analysis for commercial data is at the not at the leaf nodes. It's about annual sales, whereas a lot of science is actually at the leaf nodes. It's about looking at statistical variation in the half-hourly data. So we end up building sort of, I think of it as different shaped cubes than if it was commercial data.
Mm-hmm.
And let me add, as a scientist, we'll present this, let's say, a spreadsheet of data, but there'll be lots of gaps in that spreadsheet for several reasons. One is if there's a thunderstorm or something and it causes the instrument to malfunction when we calibrate the instruments, or often we have to comply with meteorological steady conditions, steady winds, above some threshold of climate conditions. And so we actually apply a lot of data quality control assurance to the data set and actually produce a lot of gaps. Now, the problem is any user of that data wants a continuous record, especially a modeler. They want to come up with annual sums or daily sums or weekly sums. And so the next stage in working with the database system is to find out ways to fill these gaps, essentially. And then the other factor is to what we call partition the fluxes. We want to understand mechanisms. As micrometeorologists, we measure the net ecosystem exchange. But that's due to a component due to photosynthesis and a component due to respiration.
Mm-hmm.
And by separating out day and nighttime data, we can actually derive these components. And so then we produce these type of numbers and put them in the database also. And so it's all this value added from beyond just the data archive being deposited to the NASA DAC, essentially.
So if I'm a member of this site and I go to the data browsing tab and I find pivot tables there. So there's one on drill down values and there's one on sites by vegetation type and so on. And I looked at a couple of things. Now that's, you know, they don't mean much to me, but you know, to someone to whom this stuff is meaningful, what's, you know, how are those pivot tables being used?
Well, to actually look at cross-site analyses. For example, we're interested in how length of the growing season may affect net carbon exchange. And I did this analysis before I'd met Catherine, and I essentially manually went and opened a bunch of spreadsheets and cut and paste and cut and paste, and it took forever. And luckily, I didn't get carpal tunnel syndrome, but yeah, it was a pain in the butt. And with the cube, push a couple buttons, and the data's there.
Yeah.
I mean, it really allows you to do a lot of quick so what questions to inquire up to the database and be creative. I think it makes our work much quicker and easier.
And how is this concept of partitioning that you mentioned expressed in terms of the presentation that we see on the site?
You'll see columns called GPP and REco, and those are actually these partitioned fluxes. So these are produced and populated into the database.
Okay.
So essentially we're trying to look under the hood and understand the mechanism.
Yeah, we're also doing a fair amount of sorting. One of the things that DataCubes is really good for is slicing data, sorting data. So you can sort data along vegetation types, so you can see the difference between croplands and grasslands. We've also been working with scientists. So, for example, we know each of the sites that is a boreal forest. So you can look at just the boreal forest or just the tropical rainforest. And being able to deal with a data set which has 900 and some odd site years and find just the 200 or 300 site years that you care about most for a piece of analysis.
Okay. Is it fair to say that until this was brought together in this way, it just wasn't possible to do that?
It was possible, but it was really tedious.
Yeah.
And back then, the network was small. I mean, when we first started, I had my postdoc, Eva Falgun. We had a workshop at the Marconi Center here in California in 2000. And essentially, we had 100 site years of data from maybe 30 sites. So, it was easy to be clunky. But, now we have 900 site years from 400 sites, and you can't use the old methods. They're just it's too inefficient. It's too cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to go modern. And the great thing about being here in Berkeley is there's a lot of smart people that develop a lot of these computer stuff, and so I think we're negligent if we don't ask them to help us.
So what kinds of collaboration effects do you think you're seeing as people, well, I guess it's still fairly new, right, the site, but, for example, in the report that I found, another statement is that it's a big challenge to motivate scientists to contribute the ancillary data in a standard way, and presumably getting the stuff out in front of people like this in a common presentation with explanations about what all these variables are and what they mean and how to produce them is going to be kind of a key thing into getting everybody on the same page, right?
John, I think there's a couple of things that I see going on, and Dennis can chime in too. Firstly, this census activity, I think, is one of the first where there has been so much data in one place, and we're starting to see mail from individual tower owners asking questions and telling us what's wrong.
Hmm.
I'm sorry, my site isn't actually at that lat long, or my leaf area index is really this,
mm-hmm.
because they see their data being used in papers. We're hosting access for about, I think it's 60 paper writing teams, and as the papers come to fruition, we're actually tracking what sites they're using. So it's possible as a tower owner to go in and find out who's used my data.
Cool.
And it's motivating. I know my postdoc, she's so excited when people write to her that they're using the data. I mean,
absolutely.
It helps validate them as scientists and people that they're producing something that's worthwhile and of interest to other colleagues, essentially.
So that sort of explains why you have some update features here on the site?
Absolutely. All data gets cleaned all the time. I mean, you're constantly improving algorithms, improving the data that you have archived. Since this is really the first time that this large set has been used, particularly the ancillary data, we know that there's a lot of corrections that we need to make,
mm-hmm.
where we've mistaken a site or whether it's updated data. So treating that as a living, breathing data set and being able to respond in an organized way to changes and inform people who are using the data that, oh, by the way, that site really does have a fire.
Mm-hmm. You have more eyes on it. I mean, it's kind of this idea of the wisdom of crowds or open source coding, essentially.
Mm.
As more eyes look at it, they can help us fix it.
And absolutely.
And especially our own data. I mean, you look at it, and you just sometimes gloss over it. You just don't see it, that problem. And then someone has to use it, and oops. In fact, we found this problem with our soil heat flux plate recently. We were doing the correct calculations in 2000 through 2003, and we changed staff, and the algorithm changed, and all of a sudden there was this glitch in how the data were being processed. And finally, some scientists from UCLA wanted to use the data, and we started plotting it up and go, oh, and so now we're correcting that and making it better, and it's been wonderful to help us out.
We've found a various sort of little glitches along the way. We were talking about time earlier. One of the things that happens when you plot all the data over time is you can see any errors in time reporting. One of the sites had a time reporting that was off by a couple of months, basically thinking that it was April when in fact it was, I think, June. And the data looks fine when you plot just that site, right? It goes up and it goes down and varies through the year. But if you plot it by nearby sites, suddenly you realize, boy, there's a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of data cleaning, reprocessing, making the data set come into focus that we're, frankly, engaged in right now.
It's pretty cool also that, you know, to me, coming from a background of a lot of experience and interest in online collaboration, you know, the notion that you've got the data here and you've got tools for viewing and manipulating the data, you've got tools for updating the data, but you also have this kind of conversational infrastructure, right? So there's a blog hanging off of this thing, and there's places where people can add comments and have discussions with one another, and all of that gets, you know, kept together with the data, right? Which kind of goes to Catherine, your point I thought was really good in your email, which is that this notion of the role of a data curator in science is really kind of emerging. And is going to be a key thing as we get to these kind of mega science collaborations and, you know, this stuff that involves, you know, was tens of people, now is hundreds or thousands of people all working on the same data, right? You need an environment for those conversations to be centralized as well as the data to be centralized.
Absolutely.
Well, in fact, I'd even add, we have a role for ourselves almost a little bit as a traffic cop just to avoid redundant efforts.
Yeah.
On one hand, you don't want to prevent someone from using the data, but in some respects, it's easy to cherry pick. There's certain obvious ideas, and several groups may want to do it. And in the long run, it becomes a waste of effort if people are doing the same redundant analysis, and only one paper may get published, or incorrectly, two papers doing the same thing may get published. And if we can act as traffic cop and get these people to talk to each other and maybe interact as opposed to just doing a redundant exercise.
Catherine also makes, this is just a great comment, which I want to make sure to get into this thing. She says, again, from this email, putting the same care into publishing data as you would publishing a paper is not yet socialized, which I think is a really nice way to put it.
Yeah, no, it's not. And yet we're seeing it again and again across the various collaborators I'm working with, not only Fluxnet, of just how difficult it is to put the data in a box and tie it up with a bow so you can reuse it. It's very hard and very, very important long-term for a lot of these environmental problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, Catherine, by marking these data sets and giving them some sort of, provenance, whatever, is this a way that maybe scientists now can start putting on their resume that I submitted this data set on this date, et cetera, and maybe use it? It might be great literature, but at least it's something they can get credit for.
You know, the challenge, I think, is not enabling that, but teaching the funding agencies that that's just as important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'd say it's both, you know, and I had a version of this conversation with Timo Hanne, who runs the web development for Nature Publishing, and that's a huge interest of his, is exactly what you said, Dennis, which is, you know, this is, you know, science is an enterprise which runs on people getting credit for things, and it has historically been hard to get credit for the data that you produce, right? You know, a lot of times I gather, reports are published, which are kind of a thin gloss on a data set just as an excuse to, you know, to get it out there because we haven't had a model for publishing the data. And, you know, to what you said before, right? The fact that the data from somebody's individual tower be traced back and traced through its use in follow-on reports, I mean, that's huge, right? That says that, like you said, you know, your graduate student can absolutely not only get a kick out of seeing her data be used, but can, you know, cite that and get credit for other people citing it. And that's I think, a powerful...
Well, this really leads us to the point of actually co-authoring on papers now, because there's a lot of work in terms of creativity and writing analysis of a small cohort, and obviously deserve credit for that productivity. And yet there's still some desire and needs to possibly have the co-authors of people who submitted data. But that's where it gets a little bit gray, is you start to get these papers that may use data from 400 sites that you may just use one data point. And the question is, should everyone really merit co-authorship, especially if they don't even read the paper or respond to you? Yet, to keep that social grease going, in the past, it's been kind of standard to do so.
Yeah.
I guess we're at that threshold between being a small group where it's easy to make everyone co-authors, make everybody happy, and move on, to where it becomes even really cumbersome. And maybe to help solve that problem is that scientists do get credit for publishing their data sets, and then that can be cited by the smaller group who actually does the interpretation and the analysis across sites.
Absolutely, or at least having the possibility of doing that in a sane way is new and really important, I think.
I tend to agree. Particularly, we're seeing the modeling community starting to use the data, and that's a case where the people that are using the data literally have never met most of the people who contributed the data.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, just there's no vehicle for the conversation, and I find that terrifically interesting.
Well, that's so, kind of our next workshop we'll probably have is to get some of them together.
So this might be an unfair question, but I'm sure people will wonder. I mean, this is obviously a hot topic, right? CO2 flux as it relates to climate change. Have there been papers published out of this work so far that have brought new insight in that? I mean, you know, what have we actually learned at this point?
Yeah. I mean, there's some of the larger scale papers. One is by Philip Sias and colleagues from Europe, and they essentially use this network in combination with remote sensing and their modeling to actually see how carbon exchange across Europe responded to that large drought and heat spell in 2003. And so here was this network poised to actually measure how the whole biosphere responded to this essentially climate or weather assault to itself. And that was quite fascinating. And another thing our network has been very successful is what we call emergent scale processes. And the one that really comes out from across the network is this idea that plant canopies respond to light more efficiently if the light's diffuse as it's opposed to when it's clear skies. And it gets back to how photons actually travel through complex vegetation canopies as opposed to hitting individual leaves. So this is really, a successful scale emergent process we haven't seen before. And another one we've found, because we have continuous records, is that in many semi-arid conditions, if there's a summer rain event, microbes turn on immediately and produce huge amounts of respiration that we'd never envisioned before. And often, scientists in the past would just use chambers, and they just go out periodically, and they would miss these extreme events. And so by having continuous measurements, we can actually see how the system responds, and it's very, very intermittent, essentially.
But you wouldn't necessarily argue that any long-term trends are evident in the 15 or 20 years worth of history that you have?
No, well, if any trends are existing, they seem to be more related somewhat to ecosystem dynamics. Many of the forests that are under study were disturbed back at the turn of the 19th hundreds, essentially.
Right.
They're kind of going through that natural cycle of growth, maturity, and decay, essentially. And so those ecological features are weighing on top of any potential climate trends. And many of the sites, year-to-year variation in rainfall is pretty great, so it's hard to see any climate trend in rainfall. My own site, I look at what temperatures increased, I think a degree and a half, that's over 50 years, and we've only made measurements 6 years, so it's really impossible to see any trends on that length.
Right. So it's more about having an infrastructure in place that allows us to, well, first of all, have the data in hand going forward, but second of all, it sounds like to be able to do some experiments, right? Make some predictions about, well, if this drought does occur, right, then we would predict that the system would respond in this way, and if it does or doesn't, then we either do or don't know something.
Well, in fact, one of the big things we are seeing with this network is changing of the growing season length. As systems have gotten warmer, the spring is occurring earlier, and it's really affecting carbon uptake with the citrus forest. So they have essentially a longer growing season. Now, the big unknown is in certain situations, if you have an earlier spring, it may be followed also by summer drought. And so you have an increase of carbon in the spring, but then you have a reduction in the summertime, and these two factors may cancel one another. But then, by having our measurements, we actually see the mechanisms. We can actually understand and parse out what is happening and why. Whereas in the past, scientists would come and cut down trees and look at tree rings and just get one integrated snapshot for the whole year and not really understand why, because those tree rings were also affected by drought and temperature and ozone and elevated CO2 and other issues, essentially.
This is fascinating.
It's really a great time to be even trying this sort of stuff, you know what I mean?
Because
you're really at that juxtaposition of the social need, the scientific need, and the availability of cheap technology.
And from our NSF grant, we're really encouraged for outreach, and so I view this very well as an opportunity for us to outreach to the broader community.
So I definitely
want it for the non-scientists, if possible.
One of the things that Jim Gray used to always point out was that the postdocs are the folks in any collaboration who most embrace new technology and move the entire collaboration forward. Right, as they mature in their careers. And knowing the guys over in Carper Europe, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
And you can see it happening with your own postdocs, Dennis.
Well, we have to forget all the other stuff we've learned that's not relevant anymore. It's our problem. I learned that. It was important back in 1985. But now it's not.
Yeah.
One thing that I could find out more about is, you know, how is this cube getting built? What was the collaboration between Catherine and your folks and the scientists to get that to happen?
We're very lucky in that we're starting with a reasonably well-processed data set coming from our colleagues in Europe, who then also get data that is also reasonably processed from the original network. Building the rest, Dennis gave us, I looked at 300 of Dennis's graphs from various teaching things, from various papers. I also got a similar collection from two of his other colleagues in Fluxnet, Bev Law, and then some stuff from Dario over in Europe. And I went through all of those graphs and papers, and not from trying to understand the science, but trying to understand how the data is manipulated, how is it displayed.
That's a good idea. I didn't realize you did that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That would be helpful, actually, because you see the products that we're trying to produce from these databases.
Yeah.
But with larger data sets, essentially.
Absolutely. And
that's good to hear.
It's kind of, you know, classified the graphs into effectively time series plots, scatter plots, and everything else. And then started weeding through the ways in which the data was sorted, searched, filtered, trying to figure out how should we organize this data to enable that class of graphs.
Oh, great.
Very interesting. So it's like reverse engineering based on the existing outputs.
Because, Catherine, there's many graphs I actually want to replot with this new database, actually.
Well, Dennis and I, you and I should have lunch, and we should just figure out how to rip out a bunch of graphs.
Yeah, because I am very inefficient. That's my problem, since I am not a young postdoc anymore.
Yeah, but between our postdocs, we hope we've got something done here.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, we should then.
So I'll have my postdocs contact your postdocs.
Move producers now. your people.
Well, it's kind of really the way science happens. And after that kind of exercise, right, I kind of then took what I was seeing common and what I was seeing rarely, and then built effectively another matrix with sort of triage things into stuff that was going to be easy to do, stuff that was going to be medium to do, and stuff that I thought was really going to be hard.
Mm-hmm.
And just started in, you know, crossing off little quadrants and moving through. One of the things that happened over the period was we realized that while Excel is a great initial tool, one of the things that scientists do a lot is make 50 graphs, throw away 48, and keep two. And the ability to make a lot of graphs very, very rapidly, very, very simply, usually requires some sort of scripting, and that's when you start leaving Excel and going into MATLAB or SPLOS or one of the other scientific analysis tools.
Yeah, I'm using MATLAB a lot, and what I like about it is these cursors. You can just go around some data, and it kind of blows up, and I'm seeing things I never saw before because I didn't plot it that way. And I like having the script file because it gives me some history of actually what I was looking at. That actually is very, very helpful in terms of our scientific work.
Well, and that's why we decided last summer to go ahead and connect MATLAB directly to the Cube, mm-hmm. so that you can browse the Cube either with the reports that we make with Excel or directly mm-hmm. from MATLAB.
Mm-hmm.
Closing that 20-foot gap mm-hmm. to the scientist's house.
Hmm. Well, this has been great. I'm really glad that we got to do this.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again.
All right.
Yeah,
thanks,
Catherine,
Dennis.
We should get together and maybe talk about some graphs and whatnot.
Yeah, you in your office?
Yeah, but I'm going to a seminar right now.
I'll call you later this afternoon.
Okay.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Adios.